Tibetans right now spreads all the way from Australia, all the way to North America. India also, because you're a step closer to home. But the similarities that brings us together is our unwavering commitment to the Tibetan movement. And at the age of social media, you're able to see a lot of that. As a Tibetan American, the Tibetan movement is an issue that we constantly bring to our local officials. The works of International Campaign for Tibet, through the works of Gelug Rinpoche and the subsequent leaders who have led a dynamic institution, UN, is, with its own imperfections. One of the special rapporteurs of the UN made a statement of the conditions in Tibet being akin to a cultural genocide. It's clearly mentioned that the legal status of Tibet has not yet been determined under international law. Knocking their doors in Queens, New York, in Brooklyn, New York, also going to DC and telling them about the set of legislations that we're working on.
Unsilenced Voices of Young Tibetans is a podcast presented by the Foundation for Nonviolent Alternatives, where young Tibetans share their personal stories, experiences, opinions, and journey in exile.
Teshi Dilei, namaste, and welcome to FNVA's podcast, Unsilenced Voices of Young Tibetans. Today we have with us a Tibetan who has studied international criminal justice and human rights, among other subjects, and has prominently served as a youth representative at the United Nations Secretariat. He is among the Tibetan youth leaders in our community that played a pivotal role in the passage of several for Tibet bills in the US that have become laws, the latest being the Resolve Tibet Act. He currently serves with the Mitsubishi UFG Financial Group. So welcome to our show, Lori Gatsala.
Thanks very much. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you for, first of all, the invitation to be with you. And also, I would like to recognize and acknowledge the work that you and your organization do to sort of uplift our understanding of the Tibet-China conflict with a unique lens from India. So I appreciate and recognize the work you do and for the invitation for allowing me to be here today with you.
Oh, thank you so much, Lorila. And on that note, like, I think we have to thank our mutual friend, Hundubla, who brought us together here. So thank you, Hundu.
Thank you, Hundu, indeed.
So Lorila, first things first, what brings you to India?
India, I mean, you know, India, why not India, right? You know, India to reconnect with friends and families. India to reconnect with perhaps roots. I wouldn't be lying if I say that there's a lot of who we are as Tibetans living around the world can draw a lot of a sense of appreciation for the upbringing that we might have had in India. India to be able to also reconnect with your gurus, your spiritual side of things. India also because you're a step closer to home, but you know, you can't be in your homeland as much as you wish physically, but, you know, you are with a sense of comfort knowing that a few mountains away, you are much closer to home than you are when you're in New York. So India, why not India?
Indeed, why not India? And India is also the home of our leader, His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama. And you had the pleasure and the privilege of meeting him. So what did you feel when you met him recently?
Yeah, it is definitely a unique sense of experience for me to be able to be, just simply be in his presence. For the last few days that I was in Dharamshala, in the same presence, in the same air that we breathed, His Holiness does, it just has a unique sense of appreciation for where you are. But a profound sense of gratitude for the fact that you're able to be in his presence. And when I did meet His Holiness and in a private audience, I also had the opportunity to just be as close physically to him, but also spiritually connect with him as much as I've always wanted. And for me, it is definitely an unforgettable experience. And being with him, being in his presence, allows me to also have, you know, the blessings that he has received multiply, but also, you know, inspire myself, you know, in his presence to continue to do the work that he has done for the Tibetan movement, for its people, and to be in his presence, to be inspired to do more than what I have been able to do. So I think in many ways this experience has given me a deep sense of gratitude, a profound experience of appreciation, and of course a continued inspiration to be a better version of ourselves in the spiritual realms of things, but also be able to continue to contribute to the movement as we move forward in the path forward ahead. So definitely a great experience, to say the least.
That's really wonderful to hear, and I believe meeting His Holiness is something everyone around the world aspires to, but it's very unfortunate that our sisters and brothers inside occupied Tibet are not being able to, you know, take this opportunity due to the current government, for that matter.
Right.
So moving on, Lojala, like, you have been born and brought up in India, you grew up in USA. So what differences do you find between India and the USA, particularly when it comes to the Tibetan freedom movement and the Tibetan community as a general?
It's interesting that you bring that because in my view, primarily there are a lot more that brings us together as Tibetans, be it in India, be it in the US and around the world. The similarities that brings us together is our unwavering commitment to the Tibetan movement. And at the age of social media, you're able to see a lot of that. You know, the movement in Paris recently regarding the museum and the naming convention of the Tibet, regarding any sort of, you know, initiatives that individuals around the world, be it Tibetans, Tibet support groups that we're taking. One thing that is common is the fact that we have a growing momentum, an unwavering commitment of the Tibetan people to the movement. And that is profoundly clear. But as someone who has been brought up in the US, what I've also observed is the fact that there are unique benefits or advantages of being a Tibetan origin person of American citizen, right? And as a unique experience of actually being able to vote, the right to vote, right? And as nascent as it may sound, or as a very much a common knowledge as it may sound to a lot of us, the right to vote is actually a very important aspect of our Tibetan American journey so far. In my observation, what I've been able to also see is that if you are able to exercise your right to vote, to be able to elect a leader in your local municipal, a political sphere, if you're able to exercise your right to vote and vote in state assembly members, in state senators, and also vote at the federal level in electing your congressional members, you have a unique ability to influence, you know, those individuals who you have elected in the office, because by the nature of you voting these individuals in favor in the offices that they currently reside, they are also accountable to you as your own constituents, right? So in that, what it does is you cultivate a space where being a constituent of the members of the legislators that you appoint, both from the municipal, state, or at the federal level, you have an opportunity to influence or to advocate for the issues that are close, that are near and dear to you. As a Tibetan American, the Tibetan movement is an issue that we constantly bring to our local officials, to our federal officials. And in all of that, we're able to lobby, to advocate for Tibet issues, be it in New York City, electing the right city council members and helping Tibetan people in the city districts with, you know, recognition surrounding the celebration of Tibetan New Year, which is actually an ongoing initiative that the council member in New York, in Queens, Julie Wan, has been taking in the New York City Council, influenced by the very constituents, Tibetans, at the city level, at the state level, at the federal level, you can actually influence the individuals. So all to say that the differences that I've been able to observe is in fact in relation to the unique sort of sense of experience of being able to vote, and ultimately carving out a space for those who will be elected in these offices to then work in addressing the issues that are close to the Tibetan people. And we have that unique sense of opportunity for Tibetan people in New York, be it in New Jersey or Boston, what have you. We have that opportunity, that platform to be able to raise our voices at the highest order of our land, and raise our voice to a point that, you know, it reaches the bills of which we worked on, reaches the desk of president, and turns into an actual land law of the land, so to speak. Right. So we, in my experience, have that unique set of toolkit that we must continue to take advantage of, and also by taking advantage, connecting with your local officials or local community members to continue to work in the right direction to preserve such a unique opportunity that we have. So that's probably what I would say in terms of some of the differences that I may have observed.
It's very interesting to know how Tibetans in America are becoming very much politically active in the American politics, for that matter, in the sense of having the right to vote their own leaders. And at the end of the day, raising the Tibet issue on a much higher and a different platform, for that matter. Mm-hmm. And something that I've come across, maybe even you might have seen, is like how Tibetans are rallying around, I think, Representative Jim McGovern recently, like they want to support him. So there was some Facebook post that I've saw, mm-hmm. but it's very interesting to see Tibetans being very active. And do you think that us Tibetans in India, you know, like mm-hmm. many of us are legally applicable to, you know, become citizens. So do you think we should also slowly start to do this sort of exercise where, you know, we can bring the Tibet issue to our very own Indian government through a different way?
I very much recognize the fact that there is a lot of ways in which the Tibetan people outside of U.S. can learn from the best practices of the achievement of the Tibetan people in the U.S. What we create is an opportunity, a platform to cultivate best practices and folks around the world, including in India, to sort of take lessons, right, from lessons learned from these experiences and be able to see how you can then replicate that into the workings of your own legislature. Not all government works the same, not all institutions work the same, not all countries have the similar form of governance, but there are unique opportunities in its own right to have the ability to exercise. So rightfully, in the case of India, if we have a significant number of individuals who may have that ability to exercise the right to question their leadership, the right to raise your concern about the issue that are near and dear to you. And if there is, in fact, an opportunity to advocate and lobby like we do in the U.S., we must figure ways to sort of see how best practices can be learned and observed and be able to also then replicate into your local outfits. But, you know, I do observe and recognize the fact that, you know, not all government and agencies and institutions can be as open to the idea of letting folks in to their own private spaces to have their issues raised. And every country is unique in their own way of governance. But if there is such an opportunity, I believe there is a lot of lessons to be learned from the achievements of what we have been able to progressively, achieve within the U.S. And then by no means this is sort of the very end of where we can reach. In my view, the foundations have been set by the works of International Campaign for Tibet, through the works of Geri Rinpoche and the subsequent leaders who have led the initiative to actually to its prominence. And especially individuals who've worked with the ICT, raising the unique opportunity that they have to lobby at the US Congress on the issues of Tibet, has definitely to be recognized. And from them, there is a lot of, you know, many other ways in which the ICT Europe works with different European countries and their member states to replicate such an effort. So to address your question, you know, there definitely is an appetite and a space for such, you know, practices in India as well. And I think, you know, forums like this, forums like others should sort of work to collaborate with organizations that has these knowledge and capacity to see how we can sort of best exercise that right to achieve such goals.
Indeed, and it would not only be us Tibetans, you know, voting. Like these days we have leaders in different countries, like in Canada, Putila Kapuche. Mm-hmm. In America, we have Aftab Purewal, mm-hmm. you know, like her, his mother being a Tibetan. In Europe also, there are different Tibetan leaders holding, you know, government positions in different matters. Mm-hmm. So moving on, Lodula, like I've mentioned in your introduction that you worked at the United Nations. Mm-hmm. So what do you think United Nations as an organization can do for the Tibetan freedom movement to get traction, considering the fact that there have been various resolutions passed on Tibet, but all of which have been several decades back? I mean, and on top of this, there was some good news recently in the sense that 15 different Western countries raised the issue of Tibet and East Turkestan, for that matter, in the UN General Assembly.
Yeah. I'll take your first point first. I've had the unique opportunity to work with the UN as a UN youth representative. I've had the opportunity to intern with organizations that are affiliated with the UN. And sort of in my sort of way of climbing up the ladder within the UN system, been able to interact with a number of different international non-governmental organizations, having their consultancy status affiliation with the UN, I've been able to work in my capacity as youth-led initiatives and at global stage through the UN. There's a platform under which the Youth Steering Committee within the Department of Public Information, or what used to be DPI, now the Department of Global Communications Civil Society Unit, allows space for young people to interact with the UN system as a whole. It allows opportunity for the young members of the Youth Steering Committee to participate in discussions of the UN General Assembly, the committee, different committees of the UN General Assembly. And also, as part of the UN Youth Program, you also have the ability to interact through the ECOSOC Youth Forum, the High-Level Political Forum, and a number of different important initiatives. And one of which I am quite proud to have been a small part of is the passage in the year 2015, the passage of Resolution 2250, a one-of-a-kind resolution from the UN Security Council that talks on the importance of participation of youth in peace and security. It talks about three P's: the protection, partnership, and now I'm forgetting the third P. Basically, participation. It basically talks about the importance of engagement of youth in all levels of decision-making within the UN, within different countries that are part of the UN member states, allowing the countries to realize the importance of the very unique and important skills and the contributions that youth can make to the decision-making table. And in all of that, I say this to say that I've been able to understand and observe what a dynamic institution, UN, is, with its own imperfections. UN, in my view, will never be a perfect institution. It will continue to aspire to uplift the world from the issues of conflicts and insecurities, and food insecurity, malnourishment. But I don't think the UN needs to be a perfect institution. I'm often reminded by the quote of the second Secretary General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, who actually lost his life in promotion of peace in the issue of Congo, who once said, "The UN is not created to bring humanity to heaven, but to save humanity from hell." Paraphrase it a little bit. In that, you know, what you realize is that UN as an institution will continue to be an imperfect institution, but its importance to the global operations of things, from anything from the UNICEF feeding hundreds of millions of young kids and children around the world, to the OCHA, the Office of Humanitarian Affairs, sort of working to alleviate sufferings of many individuals held in the crossfire of wars and conflicts. All to say that given what the UN has been able to do, it has a lot of space for improvement, and especially within the UN Security Council, there has been a number of different discussions, often led by India and other developing and middle powers, so to speak, rightly assert the terminology that has been thrown around a lot these days, in its own sort of sense of rightful position within the UN Security Council, of which the membership has been created post World War II, of the victors of which had the privilege of sitting as a permanent five members. And And such a group of individual nation states doesn't necessarily reflect the arrangement of power in today's world. So I very much agree with the fact that there needs to be a lot of changes, reformations within the Security Council and otherwise that needs to be done. When it comes to the UN as an institution, we have also a tendency to view UN simply through the UN Security Council or through the UN General Assembly. And it's of profound joy that we have been able to actually establish, or at least a number of countries have been able to vote in favor of passing resolutions on Tibet in the 60s and 70s. However, we have not been able to actually see a similar level of support in the passage of any sort of new resolutions on Tibet. And a lot has to be blamed for the ways in which China has asserted its power within the UN institution. We had a prior discussion about how China now sits next to the US in being one of the largest funders of the UN, funding also one of the biggest number of troops in the UN peacekeeping operations, the Blue Helmets around the world. With such level of contribution to the UN, it also comes with the level of influence and the ways in which they can almost dictate how a country must behave in their voting procedures. We've also seen the interest of China in many African, many South American, Asian, and even up to now the European countries in which the engagements of China through its developmental funds, through its infrastructure projects, through the different manifestations of the Belt and Road Initiative projects. In many ways, in return of these projects, China also expects a lot of these countries to vote in favor of the motions or the ideas that they stand. And in many ways, this also obstructs our ability to stand ourselves in institutions like UN. But there are other ways, in my view, that can be beneficial to our movement. Within the UN General Assembly itself, we have the six different committees. The GA1 talks about the disarmament and international security. GA2 talks about the ECOFIN, the economic and financial aspects of the UN. The third talks about humanitarian, social, fourth on the special political decolonization, fourth budgetary, fifth budgetary, and then legal subsequently on the sixth. Also mentioned that all these different committees have different rights and different responsibilities and duties, so to speak. The civil society organizations that are affiliated with the UN has also the capacity to actually partake and participate in all these different committee discussions and raise questions as part of the UN ECOSOC consultancy status. Individual organizations that has a consultancy status actually has the privilege to attend these meetings and raise questions and lobby, in essence, the governments to position themselves in the right direction. There are a lot of opportunities that we can exploit in this regard. But UN as an institution, we also have out of the UN Security Council and the General Assembly that we talked about, it's two of the six organs of the UN. The third being the Economic and Social Council, fourth, the Trusteeship Council, which currently is non-functional. And six, we have, the International Court of Justice. And then a fifth, in essence, was the Secretariat of the UN. So six different organs within the UN institutions outside of Security Council, General Assembly, there are a number of different, offices and organizations within the Secretariat that we can participate and engage as civil society organizations. One of which you have just alluded to, the work of different countries within the General Assembly, which is actually a great contribution to the wider discussion, but also something that goes along with that, what we have also seen recently in a documentary from DW, the German government-funded documentary series on Tibet, one of the special rapporteurs of the UN made a statement of the conditions in Tibet being akin to a cultural genocide. That comes from a UN special rapporteur. That is that's actually a process within the UN Human Rights Council regime. The Human Rights Council has special rapporteur projects where we have thematic versus country-specific responsibilities, where the special rapporteur will report on issues specific to on discrimination of people, on genocide, on crimes against humanity. All of which gives an opportunity for the Tibetan people and our organizations to work with these rapporteurs or their research to contribute to the understanding of the issue of Tibet. We also have, under the UN human rights regime, the UPR, the Universal Periodic Review, where the Tibetan movement so far has progressively found its place through our like-minded civil society organizations to participate in the review of human rights practices of the members of the Human Rights Council. China being one of the members have been reviewed three times already. If I'm not mistaken, our Tibetan affiliated organizations have had the opportunity to actually raise our voices there and pressure and question the government's standing on the human rights practices. Within the UN human rights regime, you also have complaint procedures, the special procedures that we've talked about, a lot of venues where we have the opportunity to take advantage and sort of assert our place there, both in Geneva, where the Human Rights Council is located, but here in New York, where recently the ambassador of Australia, along with like-minded groups of nations, have spoke vehemently opposed to the human rights statements, human rights conditions, rather, in Tibet and in his Turkestan as well. So all to say that understanding the current reality of the UN, the position of China, and its influence around the world, I have done what I could to lay an idea, a foundation to where we can actually exercise a number of different opportunities to raise our voices within such a large global institution.
Yeah. This was very enlightening, Burla, like especially the nitty and gritty of how the United Nations works and, you know, how China is influencing for that matter. Like talking about this recent 50 nations raising the issue of Tibet and East Turkestan. Like, I think just following this, the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they came out with like saying like 100 different countries are opposing this. So this definitely shows their influence there. But there is, like you mentioned, a big space for us Tibetans to explore there, to raise the Tibet issue there, especially how the UN Special Rapporteur spoke about this in this very, you know, very interesting documentary. I think everyone should watch that.
If you haven't already.
Almost 90 minutes long, but very insightful. Gives a holistic idea of Tibet. It's not only pro-Tibet. I mean, you have even Chinese scholars speaking there. So a very interesting one, in my opinion.
Now, that is definitely true. And one of the individual who spoke in that documentary, when I was a young student at the university, I had the opportunity to actually establish the first human rights student organization at my university. One of my primary goals was to ensure that Tibet is always discussed in any sort of human rights forums. And in a school of criminal justice, there's a great emphasis on the aspect of social justice overall. So there's a great reception on the issue of discussions on human rights. And I've had the opportunity to actually invite one of the professors there in the video to actually talk about the issue of Tibet from a lens of a Chinese professor teaching in New York, understanding their sort of stands and their view to get a holistic view about the issue of Tibet, the human rights conditions in Tibet. And we also have had a number of actually speakers come in from DC, who talked about the issue of the people, the Uyghur people. And we also had the opportunity to invite individuals from the Southern Mongolian group as well. So it was a good discussion to bring about the issue of human rights in China overall, and then each different candidate sort of talking about the importance of why human rights in China needs to be changed and where their own people have been having the greatest sense of violations of human rights. So, it's definitely something that we need to be able to continue to bring forward through whatever means possible, be it through a documentary, be it through a panel discussion that you can bring, and be it through a podcast like this. So, this goes a long way, to say the least.
Human rights is one aspect of when it comes to the Tibet-China conflict. The other thing is the legal status, for that matter. Mm-hmm. So being a student of this very subject, like, what do you think is the legal status of Tibet in that matter, in the sense that what can these international agencies do when it comes to it. I mean, recently the ICJ, they came out with a statement when it comes to the Israel-Palestinian conflict going on. So it was well applauded. Do you think they can do something similar when it comes to Tibet, or do you think Chinese pressure is too much, even in such spaces?
The International Court of Justice, being one of the six organs of the UN itself, in my understanding, of course, you know, major powers within the UN system wields great influence in that court. But if, and of course, notwithstanding the sort of influence that China wields within the entire UN system, you know, we may face obstruction in such a direction of the observation of a legal status on Tibet. But the ruling of the ICJ in the case of Israel and Palestine, if it means anything, it, you know, can have its reverberations felt across, you know, people of oppressed nations. And in that direction, I feel that, you know, this could be one of the platforms where we can exercise such, you know, or at least attempt to exercise our ability to discuss on a forum like that on the legal status of Tibet. There's also the idea of universal jurisdiction under international law, you know, famous cases of you know, in Chile with Baltasar Garzón. I mean, you know, there are precedents internationally. And Spain, if I'm not mistaken, not too long ago, have attempted to actually bring to the fore the Tibet issue by using international toolkits like universal jurisdiction, on the crimes committed to the Tibetan people in Tibet by the Chinese government, using these toolkits within the international system to understand how we can sort of talk about the legal status of Tibet, how we can talk about accountability of Tibetan crimes committed against Tibetans. But, you know, the increasing power of China has also sort of, you know, overpowered our ability to sort of bring to fore some of these discussions. But one must not be disheartened by that, because there are a number of different avenues in which we can, in fact, achieve a further discussion on the legal status of Tibet. One of the point that I would like to make a note of is in relation to the recent passage of the U.S. Law, the Resolve Tibet Act. In its primary discussion, there's been a lot of discussion surrounding many aspects of the rights of Tibetan people, the self-determination of the Tibetan people and its nations, and more importantly, on the legal status of Tibet. And it's clearly mentioned in the initial sort of, you know, wordings of the law, the bill. It's clearly mentioned that the legal status of Tibet has not yet been determined under international law. And that the resolution to the Tibet-China conflict or the dispute dispute has to be resolved through dialogue. And that the bill specifically talks about the resumption of dialogue. But to revisit the very first point, the bill really sort of emphasizes that we need to continue to open discussions surrounding the actual legal status of Tibet, that under international law, consistent with that of international norms and laws, that there has not been rightfully determined an actual legal status for Tibet. And what it does is opens up space for further discussions. This bill in and of itself is an extension, as you are aware, of the initial 2002 Tibet Policy Act. And that bill has laid a foundation to what we can do on the issue of Tibet. And for us, you know, if you look at this, you know, 10-odd years later, we're able to use that as a foundation to further create more legislations in the U.S. Congress and have them sign into American laws, laws of which actually talks and discusses about the importance of undetermined legal status of Tibet. And it opens up further discussions. More countries should take inspiration from the laws that has been determined in the U.S. and be able to then replicate that, or take inspiration at least, you know, and sort of figure out ways to further build on that, because U.S. through these set of legislations have really created a foundation for other countries to, have a more extensive dialogue around these contentious topics. And I feel that legal status of Tibet will continue to be a discussion consistent with that of the international law, where we continue to find space in it.
Yeah, very interesting point, Odula, of how the legal status of Tibet remains unresolved. And if I'm not wrong, I'm not an international law student, but I believe the last case, when the ICJ, they took up the case of Tibet, I think the final one sort of makes it very clear that issue has not been resolved, the case can be taken forward again. So this definitely gives us space to, really work on the legal status of Tibet for that matter. And also, like you said, like how America has come up with this Resolve Tibet Act in short, like other countries can definitely work on it. I believe the Tse Kyong, when he recently traveled to Czech Republic for Forum 2000, he mentioned the same thing, saying how, it might not be a similar law for that matter, because each country, they have their own differences, their own ways of working and functioning for that matter. But definitely, I believe countries can take inspiration from this and create laws that sort of curbs and sort of cuts the Chinese influence, which is everywhere for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's important that you also brought the issue of Czech Republic. In Forum 2000, Czech Republic being one of an old friend of Tibet, so to speak, old given its introduction as a nation, as a country, from the founding father Václav Havel, the biggest friend of Tibet ever to exist, inviting his holiness over the Chinese pressure in the 90s to speak in a newly formulated country of Czech Republic after the Iron Curtains have been lifted. Forums like that continues to create spaces for wider discussions like that. Forum 2000 has always been a forum where leaders of like-minded nations, leaders of oppressed people and nations, gather there to talk about human rights, human values, restoration of human dignity in people that are oppressed around the world. So I believe there needs to be a very much a forum like that in which we also can participate to further extend that discussion.
So moving on, Lutla, I've seen that you've been part of this Tibetan music video, Gyopa Me. Basically meaning I have no regrets. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, watching that video, it sort of gives one an idea of the Tibetan community, not the entire picture, that is just one picture of the Tibetan community in the States. So what do you think we as Tibetans can do, especially in the region of North America, not only the US, but Canada also for that matter? Considering that approximately, this is not a fixed number, people say around 40% of the Tibetan diaspora community is based there.
Well, that's definitely true. Well, thank you for noting that as well. The very first point regarding being in a Tibetan music video. It's actually one of the few that I've been a part of. I've collaborated with a number of Tibetan artists to, in essence, in my way of contributing to understanding of the Tibetan people, the culture, the music, which are innately very much a part of us. It's our identity. Raising the cost of Tibet through different means, so to speak, right? Also through the forms of different media. I've had the opportunity to collaborate with Asian American food vloggers, food makers, to represent Tibet through food, to teach them about what Tibet is, what type of food we eat. And through that, you bring awareness to individuals with a certain level of influence in the age of social media on the YouTube channels to, in essence, not politically, but through other means, represent the issue of Tibet or the Tibetan sense of identity to be brought. Also, I believe it's also worth noting that I currently work with the Mitsubishi Financial Group, of which we have also established the very first mindfulness employee resource network. And mindfulness, we can't claim that as being Tibet, but very much at the foundation, the values of kindness, compassion, insight, all very innate to Tibetans' upbringing. And very much the way that I've been taught, I've also done what I could to bring about that value, that wisdom, little of what I have, to the fore, and express that in the form of teaching meditations, and interacting with people, bringing in people who are mindful leaders to talk about, you know, their journey in financial sectors. All to say that these are different ways in which one could bring about the issue of Tibet without fully getting into the world of day-to-day politics, if that's something that you don't like to, you know, get involved. But Tibet can be brought on through different means. That is my point. And to address your second point regarding, you know, what we can do as Tibetan people now living in North America, I think much has been talked about the way in which we have built a network of individual organizations and individuals themselves contributing to the wider movement in North America and in the U.S. specifically through the lobbying and advocacy work. That's something, in my view, aggressively over the last decade. A lot of us have been informed about it. A lot of us have seen the results of you taking 2 days off from work, traveling to D.C., and knocking the doors of our congressmen, congresswomen, our senators, and letting them know about Tibet, because as a U.S. citizen, you have that right and the responsibility and the duty to do that as Tibetans as well. So in my view, you know, if folks cannot necessarily contribute heavily to the movement, there are many ways in which you can. I mean, and it goes without saying, you know, that, you know, through your podcast, you've also sort of laid down a foundation as to how Tibetan people can, you know, be a part of the movement overall globally. But through practical means for those Tibetans, let's say in New York, we can all get together in March, you know, get in the bus and go to D.C. and talk to our legislators. The number speaks very loudly. When we show up in big groups and knock on the door of our representatives, they know and they see that Tibetan people live in their districts, that Tibetan people also are a significant member of their own constituency, and that their voices, our voices, matter. And we're able to communicate that, not just through writing an email, which is a common exercise in the U.S., but actually knocking their doors in Queens, New York, in Brooklyn, New York, also going to D.C. and telling them about the set of legislations that we're working on. It doesn't take a lot. And being there matters a lot, because a lot of the Tibet legislation so far that has been able to be approved and signed into American law, of course, a large part of the work has been done by the International Campaign for Tibet, the Office of Tibet, the facilities in D.C. Of course, the Office of Tibet and ICT has done an incredibly great job in being able to lay the foundation. But it also creates a platform for the Tibetans living in the U.S., for example, to come and participate in events like lobby days, where we're able to communicate directly to our legislators the concerns that are near and dear to us. And an indication of the increasing interest that we have been able to see in the Tibet lobby this year around, before the passage of the Resolve Tibet Act, the Tibet Lobby Day this year had more than over 200 individuals across the U.S., you know, be it from Oregon, from West Coast and California, to Midwest, to Texas and all that, up to our East Coast members, have all gathered in large numbers to knock on the doors of our representatives, to our senators, to let them know that we need to have the Tibet legislations passed. And rightfully so, these were passed. The Resolve Tibet Act, of course, given its some of the you know, change of wordings and that of, you know, issues, the hurdles that we faced initially, it has been able to come to fore. The voted upon in Congress, passed in Senate, signed into American law. And that's the power of Tibetan people in the U.S. who have the ability to exercise their right to be in the nation's capital and let their own legislators know that Tibet is important to the Americans of Tibetan origin. So I think it's an important platform for Tibetans living in the U.S. And I continue to urge, be it through my interviews with, you know, different news agencies, I continue to always, you know, work to advocate for Tibetan people living in the free world, to be a part of that, because it doesn't really take a lot from us, but it contributes a lot to the movement, because that effort really do matter. But also what I wanted to emphasize is the fact that in anything that you do as Tibetans living in North America and around the world for that matter, whatever you do as Tibetans, as Americans or Canadians of Tibetan origin for that matter, if you are a nurse, a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, a banker, a teacher, whatever you do the very best you can in your own path. So that when you do your best and the work that you have done gets recognized, you have the platform naturally as a Tibetan, people of Tibetan origin, to raise the issue of Tibet, to talk about your Tibetan identity. In and of itself brings a sense of awareness to anyone that's around you on what Tibet is, what Tibetans are, and what it could be. Perhaps an example of a pop star, Dua Lipa, who is, of course, British, but of Albanian descent. Yep. Albanians from Kosovo, in a war-stricken country, her family had to leave to the UK. There are only a couple million of Albanians in Kosovo anyways, similar to that of the numbers that we have in Tibet. But they have been able to go and live in places outside of their countries and have been able to do what they can in their own field of work, being an artist, being a celebrity. And now she's been able to bring in the attention on the issue of Kosovo, bring in world-class music festivals in Kosovo. And all of that to say that in anything that we could do, just giving an example of a tiny nation that can resemble, in many ways, the struggles of a statehood, a struggle of war, so to speak. All of that has led to people migrating out of countries, but in the places of their own host nations, they have been able to excel in the works that they do, and through which you create a platform globally. Right? You look at the Jewish lobby, for example, a lot of Jewish individuals of prominence in the U.S., their contribution to CPAC and the lobby initiatives to the laws that are passed in favor of Israel is unmatched to any sort of, you know, special interest groups. You look at the prominent Hadid family, the Bella Hadids, of which who has, you know, Palestinian heritage, talks, uses their platform to talk about the plight of Palestinian people. All of that to mention basically that in anything that we do, having an opportunity to do what we can do best in the free world, we do our best so that we can hopefully one day create our own platform to raise issues of Tibet to the rest of the world.
Indeed, Lodla, the agencies through which Tibetans can be, I mean, Tibet for that matter can be raised by Tibetans is very interesting. And I believe when it comes to the lobbying, other countries, you know, where Tibetans reside, be it Canada, mm-hmm. I mean, in Europe and Australia for that matter, they are taking it up. And definitely, I personally, being someone from India, hopefully sees in the coming years something like this being more prominent in India. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's not happening. It is happening. But sure. A coordinated sort of action when it comes to lobbying on Tibet, that is definitely needed here. So, Lodla, like being in the USA, of late, many Tibetans, you know, like everyone has been observing how Tibetans as U.S. citizens, not only U.S. citizens, citizens of other nations, mm-hmm. be it Canada, be it France, be it the Netherlands, be it Australia for that matter, travel and visit Tibet. What is your take on it? And have you by any chance met such individuals who have visited Tibet recently? If so, what were their views on Tibet?
Well, I didn't have the good fortune of meeting anyone as of date who have had the great privilege to return to the motherland. But I'm aware that there has been a recent shift or change in the EU-China treaty as some sort of a trade deal that has signed, has developed to having a two-week visa-free movement of European Schengen countries to visit China, that being China, not necessarily Tibet Autonomous mm-hmm. Region, I think you still need to go through the separate, you know, process of requesting your permit to go into Tibet. So mind you, for those who don't know, if you get a visa to go to China, you can't go into Tibet. And that still continues to be the case in this change, if I'm not mistaken. But you still are, in my understanding, able to visit the Tibetan autonomous prefectures, be it in Hainan, in Qinghai, or in the Dichin Autonomous Region, or in Yunnan or in Sichuan and in Gansu. I believe those Tibetan prefectures can be visited, but to a certain time frame. And I think, you know, it is a good opportunity for Tibetan people who may not have had the privilege of being able to meet the families that are back in Tibet, to have an opportunity to meet with them, to learn and understand how the situation is, to learn and understand the current climate of politics and political discourse in Tibet. It's a good opportunity to learn through that. But as I've mentioned earlier, I don't necessarily think that, you know, there is any changes made to this sort of tightened restriction on the Tibetan Tongass region, where, you know, the big chunk of the historical Tibet lies. You know, even to this day, to my understanding, the foreign medias, independent foreign medias, or foreign diplomats, or foreign organizations, for that matter, international human rights organizations, none of them were allowed to actually travel in Tibet. Even if you have a permit to go into Tibet, as you're aware, you have to still be continued to be guided by a local government-approved tour agency to be taken around Tibet. And you don't have the liberty to actually step out of that schedule that they create for you to listen to everyday Tibetans to understand the plight of living under the Chinese communist regime. And that continues to be the case. And what further sort of establishes that idea is the fact that the Freedom House still continues to rank Tibet as one of the least free country in the world. That after North Korea and Syria, all of that comes under after Tibet being the least free country. We don't get to hear a lot of that in, you know, your everyday news. But these individual organizations have really tried to understand exactly the current situation of human rights in Tibet, and they've not been allowed that information. And because Tibet is under such a tight gridlock that, you know, the world media organizations, the world at large, may not necessarily have the most fullest of understanding about the situation in Tibet. So I happen to address your question directly. Had the opportunity to meet with any Tibetans then, but I'm aware of these changes in the European countries. But for Americans, I'm sure the US State Department, American congressmen and senators will continue to sort of try to get into Tibet to understand the situations in Tibet. But as of now, you know, if this is an indication, the Freedom House report, that it continues to actually be one of the least free countries in the world. The US government also has passed, with a lot of our lobbying efforts conducted in 2017, 18, leading up to 18, on the passage of the Reciprocal Access to Tibet Act, which you know, basically urges the U.S. government, the State Department, for example, to sort of, you know, blacklist the Chinese government officials in violation of human rights in Tibet, but also that of to restrict and limit these individuals' access into Tibet, that the Chinese government, when they have the vision of creating more consular offices in the U.S., cannot be allowed to actually establish more consular offices in the U.S. unless they allow, you know, the consular offices to be established in Tibet, in Lhasa, and more diplomats, more American journalists are allowed to go into Tibet to understand the situation. So, you know, hopefully there is a good light of the day in that, so that we can actually go and see the foreign governments, dignitaries, foreign media organizations can one day go in Tibet and understand the situation. But as of now, I'm not of the view that that will be the case anytime soon.
Indeed, and I believe even for Tibetans who travel with these passports, many have been facing issues. I believe, if I'm not wrong, someone, a family from Netherlands or Belgium, either one of them, they faced a big issue in the sense that even though they had valid visas on their foreign passports, they were not allowed to go back. I think they were deported, or a big issue happened. So this very much shows what is exactly happening under all these developments. So it's very interesting, Lodula. So Lodula, I would have loved to ask more, but we are running short on time. So finally, I would like to ask you whether you have any messages to our fellow Tibetans worldwide and the plethora of Tibet supporters who continue to stand with us Tibetans.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the reason why we continue to have this discussion around Tibet, why Tibet still occupies the global conscience, is the fact that the Tibet support groups, the Tibet affiliated organizations, have been able to contribute to a large extent the work that they have been able to do to better the world's understanding on Tibet. And as a result, a lot of us continue to live off that inspiration to do more and to do better in what we do. So it definitely, first of all, you know, goes without saying, the work of the Tibet support groups, the Prince of Tibet overall, the Tibetan people in general, needs to be applauded, because for a lot of us, these works continue to help us instill hope and find inspiration to continue to do bigger, better things for Tibet. But what I also think is an important aspect of the movement as we move forward is there's a lot that one needs to learn and collaborate with one another. There's a lot that one can, you know, contribute to the discussion and create a platform for collaboration of the movement in Tibetan people living across the world. The Tibetans right now spreads all the way from Australia all the way to North America. And in that, you know, geographic exposure, we also have the exposure to a number of different opportunities for Tibetan people in the countries that they reside. And in all of that, I want to encourage everybody that I've mentioned earlier to do what they do in their daily lives, but to do what they do in the best of their capacity to be able to create a platform for yourself to raise awareness about Tibet, and also continue to collaborate and share best practices of lessons learned through lobbying practices in New York, through practices of advocacy in Geneva, through all of that, to collaborate our effort to see how the movement can be moved forward, because I feel that there is a lot of reason for us to be hopeful, and we must continue to find inspiration in the work that we do around the world.
So on that note, Lurila, thank you for sharing such valuable insights. You know, I think our audience, even I myself, learned a lot from here. So we, our audience, would learn a lot, including the nitty and gritty of United Nations, for that matter, and Tibetans, the Tibetan diasporic community outside of India, what they are doing, you know, moving ahead. So thank you so much, Lurila.
Thanks very much. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and thank you for your continued work in uplifting our understanding of the world surrounding Tibet, India, and China.
For more updates and videos by FNVA, click on the link and please subscribe to our channel. Thank you for watching.